any hopes the directors had of achieving the record attendance necessary to generate a profit. By now, the new science of bacteriology pioneered by Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur had convinced most public health officials that contaminated drinking water caused the spread of cholera and other bacterial diseases. Chicago's water teemed with bacteria, thanks mainly to the Chicago River. In a monumental spasm of civic engineering, the city in 1871 reversed the river's direction so that it no longer flowed into Lake Michigan, but ran instead into the Des Plaines River and ultimately into the Mississippi, the theory being that the immense flows of both rivers would dilute the sewage to harmless levels, a concept downriver towns like Joliet did not wholeheartedly embrace. To the engineer's surprise, however, prolonged rains routinely caused the Chicago River to regress and again pour dead cats and fecal matter into the lake, and in such volume that tendrils of black water reached all the way to the intake cribs of the city water system. Most Chicago residents had no choice but to drink the water. Burnham, however, believed from the start that the fair's workers and visitors needed a better, safer supply. In this, too, he was ahead of the age. On his orders, his sanitary engineer, William S. McHarg, built a water sterilization plant on the fairgrounds, which pumped lake water through a succession of large cedar tanks in which the water was aerated and boiled. McHarg's men set big casks of the sterilized water throughout the park and replenished the casks every day. Burnham planned to close the purification plant by opening day and give visitors a choice between two other supplies of safe water: lake water, purified with Pasteur filters and offered free of charge, or naturally pure water for a penny a cup, piped 100 miles from the coveted springs of Waukesha, Wisconsin. In November 1891, Burnham ordered McHarg to investigate five of Waukesha's springs to gauge their capacity and purity, but to do so quietly, suggesting he was aware that running a pipeline through the village's comely landscape might prove a sensitive issue. No one, however, could have imagined that in a few months McHarg's efforts to secure a supply of Waukesha's best would lead to an armed encounter in the middle of a fine Wisconsin night. What most worried Burnham was fire. The loss of the Granis block with his and Root's headquarters remained a vivid, humiliating memory. A catastrophic fire in Jackson Park could destroy the fair. Yet within the park, fire was central to the construction process. Plasterers used small furnaces called salamanders to speed drying and curing. Tinners and electricians used fire pots for melting, bending, and fusing. Even the fire department used fire. Steam engines powered the pumps on the department's horse-drawn fire trucks. Burnham established defenses that by prevailing standards seemed elaborate, even excessive. He formed an exposition fire department and ordered the installation of hundreds of fire hydrants and telegraphic alarm boxes. He commissioned the construction of a fireboat, the Fire Queen, built specifically to negotiate the park's shallow canals and to pass under its many low bridges. Design specifications required that every building be surrounded with an underwater main and plumbed with interior standpipes. He also banned all smoking on the grounds, although here he made at least two exceptions. One for a contractor who pleaded that his crew of European artisans would quit if denied their cigars, the other for the big hearth in his shanty, around which he and his engineers, draftsmen, and visiting architects gathered each night for wine, talk, and cigars. With the onset of winter, Burnham ordered all hydrants packed in horse manure to prevent freezing. On the coldest days, the manure steamed as if the hydrants themselves were on fire. When Saul Bloom returned to the office of Mike DeYoung, he was confident DeYoung could not possibly accept his salary request, for he had decided to ask for the same salary as the President of the United States, $50,000. "The more I thought about it," Bloom recalled, "the more I enjoyed the prospect of telling Mike DeYoung that no less a sum could compensate me for my sacrifice in leaving San Francisco. DeYoung offered Bloom a seat. His expression was sober and expectant. Bloom said, "Much as I appreciate the compliment, I find that my interests lie right here in this city. As I look ahead, I can see myself..." DeYoung cut him off. Softly, he said, "Now, Saul, I thought you were going to tell me how much you wanted us to pay you." "I didn't want you to think I didn't appreciate." "You said that a minute ago," DeYoung said. "Now tell me how much money you want." This was not going quite the way Bloom had expected. With some trepidation, Bloom told him the number. $1,000 a week. DeYoung smiled. "Well, that's pretty good pay for a fellow of 21. But I have no doubt you'll earn it." In August, Burnham's chief structural engineer, Abraham Gottlieb, made a startling disclosure. He had failed to calculate wind loads for the fair's main buildings. Burnham ordered his key contractors, including Agnew and Company, erecting the manufacturer's building, to stop work immediately. For months, Burnham had been combating rumors that he had forced his men to work at too fast a pace, with the result that buildings were unsafe. In Europe, some press reports held that buildings had been condemned. Now, here was Gottlieb, conceding a potentially catastrophic error. Gottlieb protested that even without an explicit calculation of wind loads, the buildings were strong enough. "I could not, however, take this view," Burnham wrote in a letter to James Dredge, editor of the influential British magazine Engineering. Burnham ordered all designs strengthened to withstand the highest winds recorded over the previous 10 years. "This may be going to extremes," he told Dredge, "but to me it seems wise and prudent in view of the great interests involved." Gottlieb resigned. Burnham replaced him with Edward Shankland, an engineer from his own firm who possessed a national reputation as a designer of bridges. On November 24, 1891, Burnham wrote to James Dredge to report that once again he was under fire over the issue of structural integrity. "The criticism now," he wrote, "is that the structures are unnecessarily strong." Bloom arrived in Chicago and quickly discovered why so little had been accomplished at the Midway Plaisance, known officially as Department M. Until now, it had been under the control of Frederick Putnam, a Harvard professor of ethnology. He was a distinguished anthropologist, but putting him in charge of the Midway, Bloom said years later, was about as intelligent a decision as it would be today to make Albert Einstein manager of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Putnam would not have disagreed. He told a Harvard colleague he was anxious to get this whole Indian circus off my hands. Bloom took his concerns to Exposition President Baker, who turned him over to Burnham. "You are a very young man indeed to be in charge of the work entrusted to you," Burnham said. But Burnham himself had been young when John B. Sherman walked into his office and changed his life. "I want you to know that you have my full confidence," he said. "You are in complete charge of the Midway. Go ahead with the work. You are responsible only to me. I will write orders to that effect. Good luck." By December 1891, the two buildings farthest along were the Mines and Mining Building and the Woman's Building. Construction on the Mining Building had gone smoothly, thanks to a winter that by Chicago standards had been mercifully benign. Construction of the Woman's Building, however, had become an ordeal, both for Burnham and its young architect, Sophia Hayden, mainly because of modifications demanded by Bertha Honoré Palmer, head of the fair's Board of Lady Managers, which governed all things at the fair having to do with women. As the wife of Potter Palmer, she was accustomed by wealth and absolute social dominance to having her own way, as she had made clear earlier in the year when she suppressed a revolt led by the board's executive secretary that had caused open warfare between factions of elegantly coiffed and dressed women. In the thick of it, one horrified lady manager had written to Mrs. Palmer, I do hope that Congress will not become disgusted with our sex. Hayden came to Chicago to produce final drawings, then returned home, leaving their execution to Burnham. Construction began July 9th. Workers began applying the final coat of staff in October. Hayden returned in December to direct the decoration of the building's exterior, believing this to be her responsibility. She discovered that Bertha Palmer had other ideas. In September, without Hayden's knowledge, Palmer had invited women everywhere to donate architectural ornaments for the building, and in response had received a museum's worth of columns, panels, sculpted figures, window grills, doors, and other objects. Palmer believed the building could accommodate all the contributions, especially those sent by prominent women. Hayden, on the other hand, knew that such a hodgepodge of materials would result in an aesthetic abomination. When an influential Wisconsin woman named Flora Ginty sent an elaborately carved wooden door, Hayden turned it down. Ginty was hurt and angry. "When I think of the days I worked and the miles I traveled to achieve these things for the woman's building, my ire rises a little yet." Mrs. Palmer was in Europe at the time, but her private secretary, Laura Hayes, a gossip of virtuosic scope, made sure her employer learned all the details. Hayes also relayed to Palmer a few words of advice that she herself had given the architect. "I think it would be better to have the building look like a patchwork quilt than to refuse these things which the lady managers have been to such pains in soliciting." A patchwork quilt was not what Hayden had in mind. Despite Mrs. Palmer's blinding social glare, Hayden continued to decline donations. A battle followed, fought in true Gilded Age fashion with oblique snubs and poisonous courtesy. Mrs. Palmer pecked and pestered and catapulted icy smiles into Hayden's deepening gloom. Finally, Palmer assigned the decoration of the woman's building to someone else, a designer named Candace Wheeler. Hayden fought the arrangement in her quiet, stubborn way until she could take it no longer. She walked into Burnham's office, began to tell him her story, and promptly, literally, went mad. Tears, heaving sobs, cries of anguish, all of it. A severe breakdown, an acquaintance called it, with a violent attack of high nervous excitement of the brain. Burnham, stunned, summoned one of the exposition surgeons. Hayden was discreetly driven from the park in one of the fair's innovative English ambulances, with quiet rubber tires, and placed in a sanitarium for a period of enforced rest. She lapsed into melancholia, a sweet name for depression. At Jackson Park, aggravation was endemic. Simple matters, Burnham found, often became imbroglios. Even Olmsted had become an irritant. He was brilliant and charming, but once fixed on a thing, he was as unyielding as a slab of Joliet limestone. By the end of 1891, the question of what kind of boat to allow on the fair's waterways had come to obsess him, as if boats alone would determine the success of his quest for poetic mystery. In December 1891, Burnham received a proposal from a tugboat manufacturer arguing the case for steam launches at the exposition. Olmsted got wind of it from Harry Codman, who, in addition to being his chief operating man in Chicago, served as a kind of spy, keeping Olmsted abreast of all threats to Olmsted's vision. Codman sent Olmsted a copy of the letter, adding his own note that the tugboat maker seemed to enjoy Burnham's confidence. On December 23rd, Olmsted wrote to Burnham, "I suspect that even Codman is inclined to think that I make too much of a hobby of this boat question and give an amount of worry, if not thought, to it that would be better expended on other and more critical matters, and I fear that you may think me a crank upon it." He proceeded, however, to vent his obsession yet again. The tugmaker's letter, he complained, framed the boat question solely in terms of moving the greatest number of passengers between different points at the exposition as cheaply and quickly as possible. You perfectly well know that the main object to be accomplished was nothing of this sort. I need not try to make a statement of what it was. You are as alive to it as I am. You know that it was a poetic object, and you know that if boats are to be introduced on these waters, it would be perfect nonsense to have them of a kind that would antagonize this poetic object. Mere transportation was never the goal, he fumed. The whole point of having boats was to enhance the landscape. Put in the waters unbecoming boats, and the effect would be utterly disgusting, destroying the value of what would otherwise be the most valuable original feature of this exposition. I say destroy deliberately. 1,000 times better to have no boats. Despite increasing committee interference and intensified conflict between Burnham and Director General Davis, and with the threat of labor strikes ever present, the main buildings rose. Workers laid foundations of immense timbers in crisscrossed layers in accord with Root's grillage principle, then used steam-powered derricks to raise the tall posts of iron and steel that formed each building's frame. They cocooned the frames in scaffolds of wood and faced each frame with hundreds of thousands of wood planks to create walls capable of accepting 2 thick layers of staff. As workers piled mountains of fresh lumber beside each building, jagged foothills of sawdust and scrap rose nearby. The air smelled of cut wood and Christmas. In December, the exposition experienced its first death. A man named Mueller at the mines building, dead of a fractured skull. 3 other deaths followed in short order. Jansen, fractured skull, electricity building. Allard, fractured skull, electricity building. Algier, stunned to oblivion by a new phenomenon, electric shock at the mines building. Dozens of lesser accidents occurred as well. Publicly, Burnham struck a pose of confidence and optimism. In a December 28, 1891 letter to the editor of the Chicago Herald, he wrote, "A few questions of design and plan are still undetermined, but there is nothing which is not well in hand, and I see no reason why we will not be able to complete our work in time for the ceremonies in October 1892, Dedication Day, and for the opening of the exposition, May 1, 1893. In fact, the fair was clearly behind schedule, with worse delay forestalled only by the unexpectedly mild winter. The October dedication was to take place inside the manufacturer's building, yet as of January only the foundation of the building had been laid. For the fair to be even barely presentable in time for the ceremony, everything would have to go perfectly. The weather especially would have to cooperate. Meanwhile, banks and companies were failing across America. Strikes threatened everywhere, and cholera had begun a slow white trek across Europe, raising fears that soon the first plague ships would arrive in New York Harbor. As if anyone needed extra pressure, the New York Times warned, "The failure of the fair, or anything short of a positive and pronounced success, would be a discredit to the whole country, and not to Chicago alone." Remains of the Day. In November 1891, Julia Connor announced to Holmes she was pregnant. Now, she told him, he had no choice but to marry her. Holmes reacted to her news with calm and warmth. He held her, stroked her hair, and with moist eyes assured her that she had nothing to worry about. Certainly he would marry her, as he long had promised. There was, however, a condition that he now felt obligated to impose. A child was out of the question. He would marry her only if she agreed to allow him to execute a simple abortion. He was a physician. He had done it before. He would use chloroform, and she would feel nothing and awaken to the prospect of a new life as Mrs. H. H. Holmes. Children would come later. Right now, there was far too much to do, especially given all the work that lay ahead to complete the hotel and furnish each of its rooms in time for the World's Fair. Holmes knew he possessed great power over Julia. First, there was the power that accrued to him naturally through his ability to bewitch men and women alike with false candor and warmth. Second, the power of social approbation that he now focused upon her. Though sexual liaisons were common, society tolerated them only as long as their details remained secret. Packing house princes ran off with parlor maids, and bank presidents seduced typewriters. When necessary, their attorneys arranged quiet solo voyages to Europe, to the surgical suites of discreet but capable doctors. A public pregnancy, without marriage, meant disgrace and destitution. Holmes possessed Julia now as fully as if she were an antebellum slave, and he reveled in his possession. The operation, he told Julia, would take place on Christmas Eve. Snow fell. Carolers moved among the mansions on Prairie Avenue, pausing now and then to enter the fine houses for hot mulled cider and cocoa. The air was scented with wood smoke and roasting duck. In Graceland Cemetery to the north, young couples raced their sleighs over the snow-heaped undulations, pulling their blankets especially tight as they passed the tall, gloomy guardian at the tomb of Dexter Graves. Eternal silence, a hooded figure with only darkness where the face should have been. To look into this emptiness, legend held, was to receive a glimpse into the underworld. At 701 63rd Street in Englewood, Julia Connor put her daughter to bed and did her best to smile and indulge the child's delighted anticipation of Christmas. Yes, St. Nicholas would come, and he would bring wonderful things. Holmes had promised a bounty of toys and sweets for Pearl, and for Julia, something truly grand, beyond anything she could have received from her poor, bland Ned. Outside, the snow muffled the concussion of passing horses. Trains bearing fangs of ice tore through the crossing at Wallace. Julia walked down the hall to an apartment occupied by Mr. and Mrs. John Crow. Julia and Mrs. Crow had become friends, and now Julia helped Mrs. Crow decorate a Christmas tree in the Crow's apartment, meant for Pearl as a Christmas morning surprise. Julia talked of all that she and Pearl would do the next day, and told Mrs. Crow that soon she would be going to Davenport, Iowa, to attend the wedding of an older sister. An old maid, Mrs. Crow said, who to everyone's surprise was about to marry a railroad man. Julia was awaiting the rail pass that the groom was supposed to have put in the mail. Julia left the apartment late that night in good spirits, Mrs. Crow later recalled. There was nothing about her conversation that would lead any of us to think she intended going away that night. Holmes offered Julia a cheerful Merry Christmas and gave her a hug, then took her hand and led her to a room on the second floor that he had readied for the operation. A table lay draped in white linen. His surgical kits stood open and gleaming, his instruments laid out in a sunflower of polished steel. Fearful things. Bone saws, abdomen retractor, trocar, and trepan. More instruments, certainly, than he really needed, and all positioned so that Julia could not help but see them and be sickened by their hard, eager gleam. He wore a white apron and had rolled back his cuffs. Possibly he wore his hat, a bowler. He had not washed his hands, nor did he wear a mask. There was no need. She reached for his hand. There would be no pain, he assured her. She would awaken as healthy as she was now, but without the encumbrance she bore within. He pulled the stopper from a dark amber bottle of liquid and immediately felt its silvery exhalation in his own nostrils. He poured the chloroform into a bunched cloth. She gripped his hand more tightly, which he found singularly arousing. He held the cloth over her nose and mouth. Her eyes fluttered and rolled upward. Then came the inevitable, reflexive disturbance of muscles, like a dream of running. She released his hand, cast it away with splayed fingers. Her feet trembled as if tapping to a wildly beating drum. His own excitement rose. She tried to pull his hand away, but he was prepared for this sudden surge of muscle stimulation that always preceded stupor, and with great force clamped the cloth to her face. She beat at his arms. Slowly the energy left her, and her hands began to move in slow arcs, soothing and sensuous, the wild drums silent. Ballet now. A pastoral exit. He kept one hand on the cloth and with the other dribbled more of the liquid between his fingers into its folds, delighting in the sensation of frost where the chloroform coated his fingers. One of her wrists sagged to the table, followed shortly by the other. Her eyelids stuttered, then closed. Holmes did not think her so clever as to feign coma, but he held tight just the same. After a few moments, he reached for her wrist and felt her pulse fade to nothing, like the rumble of a receding train. He removed the apron and rolled down his sleeves. The chloroform and his own intense arousal made him feel lightheaded. The sensation, as always, was pleasant and induced in him a warm languor, like the feeling he got after sitting too long in front of a hot stove. He stoppered the chloroform, found a fresh cloth, and walked down the hall to Pearl's room. It took only a moment to bunch the fresh cloth and douse it with chloroform. In the hall afterward, he examined his watch and saw that it was Christmas. The day meant nothing to Holmes. The Christmas mornings of his youth had been suffocated under an excess of piety, prayer, and silence, as if a giant wool blanket had settled over the house. On Christmas morning, the crows waited for Julia and Pearl in glad anticipation of watching the girl's eyes ignite upon spotting the lovely tree and the presents arrayed under its boughs. The apartment was warm, the air rouged with cinnamon and fir. An hour passed. The crows waited as long as they could, but at 10 o'clock they set out to catch a train for central Chicago, where they planned to visit friends. They left the apartment unlocked, with a cheerful note of welcome. The crows returned at 11 o'clock that night and found everything as they had left it, with no evidence that Julia and her daughter had come. The next morning they tried Julia's apartment, but no one answered. They asked neighbors inside and outside the building if any had seen Julia or Pearl, but none had. When Holmes next appeared, Mrs. Crow asked him where Julia might be. He explained that she and Pearl had gone to Davenport earlier than expected. Mrs. Crow heard nothing more from Julia. She and her neighbors thought the whole thing very odd. They all agreed that the last time anyone had seen Julia or Pearl was Christmas Eve. This was not precisely accurate. Others did see Julia again, although by then no one, not even her own family back in Davenport, Iowa, could have been expected to recognize her. Just after Christmas, Holmes asked one of his associates, Charles Chappell, to come to his building. Holmes had learned that Chappell was an articulator, meaning he had mastered the art of stripping the flesh from human bodies and reassembling, or articulating, the bones to form complete skeletons for display in doctors' offices and laboratories. He had acquired the necessary techniques while articulating cadavers for medical students at Cook County Hospital. During his own medical education, Holmes had seen firsthand how desperate schools were to acquire corpses, whether freshly dead or skeletonized. The serious, systematic study of medicine was intensifying, and to scientists, the human body was like the polar ice cap, something to be studied and explored. Skeletons hung in doctors' offices where they served as visual encyclopedias. With demand outpacing supply, doctors established a custom of graciously and discreetly accepting any offered cadaver. They frowned on murder as a means of harvest. On the other hand, they made little effort to explore the provenance of any one body. Grave robbing became an industry, albeit a small one, requiring an exceptional degree of sang-froid. In periods of acute shortage, doctors themselves helped mine the newly departed. It was obvious to Holmes that even now, in the 1890s, demand remained high. Chicago's newspapers reported ghoulish tales of doctors raiding graveyards. After a foiled raid on a graveyard in New Albany, Indiana, on February 24, 1890, Dr. W. H. Wathen, head of the Kentucky Medical College, told the Tribune reporter, "The gentlemen were acting not for the Kentucky School of Medicine, nor for themselves individually, but for the medical schools of Louisville, to which the human subject is as necessary as breath to life." Just 3 weeks later, the physicians of Louisville were at it again. They attempted to rob a grave at the State Asylum for the Insane in Anchorage, Kentucky, this time on behalf of the University of Louisville. "Yes, the party was sent out by us," a senior school official said. "We must have bodies, and if the state won't give them to us, we must steal them. The winter classes were large and used up so many subjects that there are none for the spring classes." He saw no need to apologize. "The asylum cemetery has been robbed for years," he said, "and I doubt if there is a corpse in it. I tell you, we must have bodies. You cannot make doctors without them, and the public must understand it. If we can't get them any other way, we will arm the students with Winchester rifles and send them to protect the body snatchers on their raids." Holmes had an eye for opportunity, and with demand for corpses so robust, opportunity now beckoned. He showed Charles Chapel into a second-floor room that contained a table, medical instruments, and bottles of solvents. These did not trouble Chapel, nor did the corpse on the table, for Chapel knew that Holmes was a physician. The body was clearly that of a woman, although of unusual height. He saw nothing to indicate her identity. The body, he said, looked like that of a jackrabbit, which had been skinned by splitting the skin down the face and rolling it back off the entire body. In some places, considerable of the flesh had been taken off with it. Holmes explained that he had been doing some dissection, but now had completed his research. He offered Chapel $36 to cleanse the bones and skull and return to him a fully articulated skeleton. Chapel agreed. Holmes and Chapel placed the body in a trunk lined with duck cloth. An express company delivered it to Chapel's house. Soon afterward, Chapel returned with the skeleton. Holmes thanked him, paid him, and promptly sold the skeleton to Hahnemann Medical College, the Chicago school, not the Philadelphia school of the same name, for many times the amount he had paid Chapel. In the second week of January, 1892, new tenants, the Doyle family, moved into Julia's quarters in Holmes's building. They found dishes on the table and Pearl's clothes hung over a chair. The place looked and felt as if the former occupants planned to return within minutes. The Doyles asked Holmes what had happened. With his voice striking the perfect sober note, Holmes apologized for the disarray and explained that Julia's sister had fallen gravely ill, and Julia and her daughter had left at once for the train station. There was no need to pack up their belongings, as Julia and Pearl were well provided for and would not be coming back. Later, Holmes offered a different story about Julia. "I last saw her about January 1st, 1892, when a settlement of her rent was made. At this time, she had announced not only to me, but to her neighbors and friends, that she was going away. Although she had told everyone her destination was Iowa, in fact, Holmes said, she was going elsewhere to avoid the chance of her daughter being taken from her, giving the Iowa destination to mislead her husband. Holmes denied that he and Julia ever had engaged each other physically or that she had undergone a criminal operation, a then-current euphemism for abortion. That she is a woman of quick temper and perhaps not always of a good disposition may be true, but that any of her friends and relatives would believe her to be an amoral woman, or one who would be a party to a criminal act, I do not think. A gauntlet dropped. 1892 broke cold, with 6 inches of snow on the ground and temperatures falling to 10 degrees below zero. Certainly not the coldest weather Chicago ever experienced, but cold enough to clot the valves of all 3 of the city water system's intake valves and temporarily halt the flow of Chicago's drinking water. Despite the weather, work at Jackson Park progressed. Workers erected a heated, movable shelter that allowed them to apply staff to the exterior of the mines and mining building no matter what the temperature. The woman's building was nearly done, all its scaffolding gone. The giant manufacturer's building had begun rising above its foundation. In all, the workforce in the park numbered 4,000. The ranks included a carpenter and furniture maker named Elias Disney, who in coming years would tell many stories about the construction of this magical realm beside the lake. His son Walt would take note. Beyond the exposition's 8-foot fence and its 2 tiers of barbed wire, there was tumult. Wage reductions and layoffs stoked unrest among workers nationwide. Unions gained strength. The Pinkerton National Detective Agency gained revenue. A rising union man named Samuel Gompers stopped by Burnham's office to discuss allegations that the exposition discriminated against union workers. Burnham ordered his construction superintendent, Dion Geraldine, to investigate. As labor strife increased and the economy faltered, the general level of violence rose. In taking stock of 1891, the Chicago Tribune reported that 5,906 people had been murdered in America, nearly 40% more than in 1890. The increase included Mr. and Mrs. Borden of Fall River, Massachusetts. The constant threat of strike and the onset of deep cold shaded the new year for Burnham, but what most concerned him was the fast-shrinking treasury of the Exposition Company. In advancing the work so quickly and on such a grand scale, Burnham's department had consumed far more money than anyone had anticipated. There was talk now among the directors of seeking a $10 million appropriation from Congress, but the only immediate solution was to reduce expenditures. On January 6th, Burnham commanded his department chiefs to take immediate, in some cases draconian, measures to cut costs. He ordered his chief draftsman in charge of exposition work underway in the attic of the rookery to fire at once any man who did inaccurate or slouchy work, or who failed to do more than his full duty. He wrote to Olmsted's landscape superintendent, Rudolf Ulrich, "It seems to me you can now cut your force down 1/2 and at the same time let very many expensive men go." Henceforth, Burnham ordered, all carpentry work was to be done only by men employed by the fair's contractors. To Geraldine, he wrote, "You will please dismiss every carpenter on your force." Until this point, Burnham had shown a level of compassion for his workers that was extraordinary for the time. He paid them even when illness or injury kept them out of work and established an exposition hospital which provided free medical care. He built quarters within the park where they received 3 large meals a day and slept in clean beds and well-heated rooms. A Princeton professor of political economy named Walter Wyckoff disguised himself as an unskilled laborer and spent a year traveling and working among the nation's growing army of unemployed men, including a stint at Jackson Park. Guarded by sentries and high barriers from unsought contact with all beyond, great gangs of us, healthy, robust men, live and labor in a marvelous artificial world, he wrote. No sight of misery disturbs us, nor of despairing poverty out in vain search for employment. We work our 8 hours a day in peaceful security and in absolute confidence of our pay. But now, even the fair was laying off men, and the timing was awful. With the advent of winter, the traditional building season had come to an end. Competition for the few jobs available had intensified as thousands of unemployed men from around the country, unhappily bearing the label hobo, derived possibly from the railroad cry, "Ho, boy," converged on Chicago in hopes of getting exposition work. The dismissed men, Burnham knew, faced homelessness and poverty. Their families confronted the real prospect of starvation. But the fair came first. The absence of an Eiffel Challenger continued to frustrate Burnham. Proposals got more and more bizarre. One visionary put forth a tower 500 feet taller than the Eiffel Tower, but made entirely of logs, with a cabin at the top for shelter and refreshment. The cabin was to be a log cabin. If an engineer capable of besting Eiffel did not step forward soon, Burnham knew, there simply would not be enough time left to build anything worthy of the fair. Somehow he needed to rouse the engineers of America. The opportunity came with an invitation to give a talk to the Saturday Afternoon Club, a group of engineers who had begun meeting on Saturdays at a downtown restaurant to discuss the construction challenges of the fair. There was the usual meal in multiple courses, with wine, cigars, coffee, and cognac. At one table sat a 33-year-old engineer from Pittsburgh who ran a steel inspection company with branch offices in New York and Chicago, and which already possessed the exposition contract to inspect steel used in the fair's buildings. He had an angular face, black hair, black mustache, and dark eyes, the kind of looks soon to be coveted by an industry Thomas Edison was just then bringing to life. He was eminently engaging and social, and he had a keen sense of humor, his partners wrote. In all gatherings, he at once became the center of attraction, having a ready command of language and a constant fund of amusing anecdotes and experiences. Like the other members of the Saturday Afternoon Club, he expected to hear Burnham discuss the challenges of building an entire city on such a short schedule. But Burnham surprised him. After asserting that the architects of America had covered themselves with glory through their exposition designs, Burnham rebuked the nation's civil engineers for failing to rise to the same level of brilliance. The engineers, Burnham charged, had contributed little or nothing either in the way of originating novel features or of showing the possibilities of modern engineering practice in America. A tremor of displeasure rolled through the room. "Some distinctive feature is needed," Burnham continued, "something to take the relative position in the world's Columbian Exposition that was filled by the Eiffel Tower at the Paris Exposition." "But not a tower," he said. "Towers were not original. Eiffel had built a tower already. Mere bigness wasn't enough either. Something novel, original, daring, and unique must be designed and built if American engineers are to retain their prestige and standing." Some of the engineers took offense. Others acknowledged that Burnham had a point. The engineer from Pittsburgh felt himself cut to the quick by the truth of these remarks. As he sat there among his peers, an idea came to him like an inspiration. It arrived not as some half-formed impulse, he said, but rich in detail. He could see it and touch it, hear it as it moved through the sky. There was not much time left, but if he acted quickly to produce drawings and managed to convince the fair's Ways and Means Committee of the idea's feasibility, he believed the exposition could indeed out Eiffel Eiffel. And if what happened to Eiffel happened to him, his fortune would be assured. It must have been refreshing for Burnham to stand before the Saturday Afternoon Club and openly chide its members for their failure, because most of his other encounters over exposition business invariably became exercises in self-restraint, especially when he went before the fair's many and still multiplying committees. This constant Victorian minuet of false grace consumed time. He needed more power. Not for his own ego, but for the sake of the exposition. Unless the pace of decision-making accelerated, he knew, the fair would fall irreparably behind schedule. Yet, if anything, the barriers to efficiency were increasing in size and number. The Exposition Company's shrinking war chest had driven its relationship with the National Commission to a new low, with Director General Davis arguing that any new federal money should be controlled by his commission. The commission seemed to form new departments every day, each with a paid chief. Davis named a superintendent of sheep for a salary equivalent to $60,000 a year, and each claiming some piece of jurisdiction that Burnham thought belonged to him. Soon the struggle for control distilled to a personal conflict between Burnham and Davis, its primary battlefield a disagreement over who should control the artistic design of exhibits and interiors. Burnham thought it obvious that the territory belonged to him. Davis believed otherwise. At first, Burnham tried the oblique approach. "We are now organizing a special interior decorative and architectural force to handle this part," he wrote to Davis, "and I have the honor to offer the services of my department to yours in such manners. I feel a delicacy in having my men suggest to yours artistic arrangements, forms, and decorations of exhibits, without your full approval, which I hereby respectfully ask." But Davis told the reporter, "I think it is pretty well understood by this time that no one but the Director General and his agents have anything to do with exhibits." The conflict simmered. On March 14th, Burnham joined Davis for dinner with Japan's delegate to the fair at the Chicago Club. Afterward, Davis and Burnham remained at the club, arguing quietly until 5 o'clock the next morning. "The time was well spent," he wrote to Margaret, who was then out of town, "and we have come to a better feeling so that the path will be much smoother from this time forward." An uncharacteristic weariness crept into his letter. He told Margaret he planned to end work early that night and go to Evanston. "And sleep in your dear bed, my love, and I shall dream of you. What a rush this life is! Where do the years go to?" There were moments of grace. Burnham looked forward to evenings on the grounds when his lieutenants and visiting architects would gather for dinner at the shanty and converse into the night in front of Burnham's immense fireplace. Burnham treasured the camaraderie and the stories. Olmsted recounted the endless trials of protecting Central Park from ill-thought modifications. Colonel Edmund Rice, chief of the Exposition's Columbian Guard, described what it was like to stand in a shaded wood at Gettysburg as Pickett launched his men across the intervening field. Late in March 1892, Burnham invited his sons to join him at the shanty for one of their periodic overnight stays. They failed to arrive at the scheduled time. At first, everyone attributed their absence to a routine railroad delay, but as the hours passed, Burnham's anxiety grew. He knew as well as anyone that train wrecks in Chicago were nearly a daily occurrence. Darkness began to fall, but at last the boys arrived. Their train had been held up by a broken bridge on the Milwaukee and St. Paul line. They reached the shanty, Burnham wrote to Margaret, just in time to hear Colonel Rice tell some yarns about the war and life in the plains among the scouts and Indians. As Burnham wrote this letter, his sons were near at hand. "They are very happy to be here and are now looking at the large photographic album with Mr. Geraldine." The album was a collection of construction photographs taken by Charles Dudley Arnold, a photographer from Buffalo, New York, whom Burnham had hired as the fair's official photographer. Arnold also was present, and soon the children were to join him in a sketching session. Burnham closed, "We are all well and satisfied with the amount and variety of work our good fortune has given us to do." Such peaceful intervals never lasted long. The conflict between Burnham and Davis again flared to life. The directors of the Exposition Company did decide to seek a direct appropriation from Congress, but their request triggered a congressional investigation of the fair's expenditures. Burnham and President Baker expected a general review, but instead found themselves grilled about the most mundane expenses. For example, when Baker listed the total spent on carriage rental, the subcommittee demanded the names of the people who rode in the carriages. At one session in Chicago, the committee asked Davis to estimate the final cost of the exposition. Without consulting Burnham, Davis gave an estimate 10% below the amount Burnham had calculated for President Baker, which Baker had then included in his own statement to investigators. Davis's testimony carried with it the unstated accusation that Burnham and Baker had inflated the amount of money needed to complete the fair. Burnham leapt to his feet. The subcommittee chairman ordered him to sit. He remained standing. He was angry, barely able to keep himself composed. "Mr. Davis has not been to see me or any of my people," he said, "and any figures he has given he has jumped at. He knows nothing about the matter." His outburst offended the subcommittee chairman. "I object to any such remarks addressed to a witness before this committee," the chairman said, "and I will ask that Mr. Burnham withdraw his remark." At first, Burnham refused. Then, reluctantly, he agreed to withdraw the part about Davis knowing nothing. But only that part. He did not apologize. The committee left for Washington to study the evidence and report on whether an appropriation was warranted. "The congressmen," Burnham wrote, "are dazed with the size and scope of this enterprise. We gave them each a huge pile of data to digest, and I think their report will be funny, because I know that months would not be enough time for me to work out a report, even with my knowledge." On paper, at least, the fair's midway placence began to take shape. Professor Putnam had believed the Midway ought first and foremost to provide an education about alien cultures. Saul Bloom felt no such duty. The Midway was to be fun, a great pleasure garden stretching for more than a mile from Jackson Park all the way to the border of Washington Park. It would thrill, titillate, and, if all went well, perhaps even shock. He considered his great strength to be spectacular advertising. He placed notices in publications around the world to make it known that the Midway was to be an exotic realm of unusual sights, sounds, and scents. There would be authentic villages from far-off lands inhabited by authentic villagers. Even pygmies, if Lieutenant Shufeld succeeded. Bloom recognized also that as Tsar of the Midway, he no longer had to worry about seeking a concession for his Algerian village. He could approve the village himself. He produced a contract and sent it off to Paris. Bloom's knack for promotion caught the attention of other fair officials, who came to him for help in raising the exposition's overall profile. At one point, he was called upon to help make reporters understand how truly immense the manufacturer's building would be. So far, the exposition's publicity office had given the press a detailed list of monumental but dreary statistics. "I could tell they weren't in the least interested in the number of acres or tons of steel," Bloom wrote. "So I said, look at it this way. It's going to be big enough to hold the entire standing army of Russia." Bloom had no idea whether Russia even had a standing army, let alone how many soldiers it might include and how many square feet they would cover. Nonetheless, the fact became gospel throughout America. Readers of Rand McNally's exposition guidebooks eventually found themselves thrilling to the vision of millions of fur-hatted men squeezed onto the building's 32-acre floor. Bloom felt no remorse. The Angel from Dwight. In the spring of 1892, Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pitetzel, found himself in the city of Dwight, Illinois, about 75 miles southwest of Chicago, taking the famous Keeley cure for alcoholism. Patients stayed in the three-story Livingston Hotel, a red-brick building of simple, appealing design, with arched windows and a veranda along the full length of its facade, a fine place to rest between injections of Dr. Leslie Enrot Keeley's Gold Cure. Gold was the most famous ingredient in a red, white, and blue solution nicknamed the barber pole that employees of the Keeley Institute injected into patients' arms 3 times a day. The needle, one of large 19th-century bore, like having a garden hose shoved into a bicep, invariably deposited a yellow aureole on the skin surrounding the injection site, a badge for some, an unsightly blemish for others. The rest of the formula was kept secret, but as best doctors and chemists could tell, the solution included substances that imparted a pleasant state of euphoria and sedation, trimmed with amnesia. An effect the Chicago Post Office found problematic, for each year it wound up holding hundreds of letters sent from Dwight that lacked important elements of their destination addresses. The senders simply forgot that things like names and street numbers were necessary for the successful delivery of mail. Pitezel had long been a heavy drinker, but his drinking must have become debilitating, for it was Holmes who sent him to Keeley and paid for his treatment. He explained it to Pitezel as a gesture born of kindness, a return for Pitezel's loyalty. As always, he had other motives. He recognized that Pitezel's drinking impaired his usefulness and threatened to disrupt schemes already in play. Holmes later said of Pitezel, "He was too valuable a man, even with his failings taken into consideration, for me to dispense with." It's likely Holmes also wanted Pitezel to gather whatever intelligence he could about the cure and its labeling, so that he could mimic the product and sell it through his own mail-order drug company. Later, indeed, Holmes would establish his own curative spa on the second floor of his Englewood building and call it the Silver Ash Institute. The Keeley Cure was amazingly popular. Thousands of people came to Dwight to shed their intemperate ways. Many thousands more bought Dr. Keeley's oral version of the cure, which he marketed in bottles so distinctive that he urged purchasers to destroy the empties, to keep unscrupulous companies from filling them with their own concoctions. Every day Pitezel joined 3 dozen other men in the daily ritual of passing through the line to receive his injections. Women received theirs in their own rooms and were kept separated from the men to protect their reputations. In Chicago, hostesses always knew when guests had taken the cure, because upon being offered a drink, the guests invariably answered, "No, thank you. I've been to Dwight." Pitezel returned to Englewood in April. The psychotropic powers of Keeley's injections may account for the story Pitezel now told Holmes, of how, at Keeley, he had met a young woman of great beauty. To hear him tell it, preternatural beauty, named Emmeline Sigrind. She was blonde, 24 years old, and since 1891 had worked as a stenographer in Dr. Keeley's office. Pitezel's almost hallucinatory description must have tantalized Holmes, for he wrote to Sigrind and offered her a job as his personal secretary at twice the salary she was making in Keeley. A flattering offer, as a member of the Sigrind family later described it. Emmeline accepted without hesitation. The Institute had a certain cachet, but the village of Dwight was no Chicago. To be able to earn twice her salary and live in that city of legendary glamour and excitement, with the World's Fair set to open in a year, made the offer irresistible. She left Keeley in May, bringing along her $800 in savings. Upon arriving in Englewood, she rented rooms in a boarding house near Holmes's building. Pitezel had exaggerated Emmeline's beauty, Holmes saw, but not by much. She was indeed lovely, with luminous blonde hair. Immediately Holmes deployed his tools of seduction, his soothing voice and touch and frank blue gaze. He bought her flowers and took her to the Timmerman Opera House down the block. He gave her a bicycle. They spent evenings riding together on the smooth macadam of Yale and Harvard streets, the picture of a happy young couple blessed with looks and money. White piqué hats with black watered ribbon bands and a couple of knife feathers set at the side are the latest novelty for women cyclists, the Tribune Society column observed. As Emmeline became more accustomed to her wheel, a term everyone still used, even though the old and deadly huge-wheeled bicycles of the past had become thoroughly obsolete. She and Holmes took longer and longer rides, and often rode down the willowed midway to Jackson Park to watch the construction of the World's Fair, where inevitably they found themselves among thousands of other people, many of them also bicyclists. On a few Sundays, Emmeline and Holmes rode into the park itself, where they saw that construction was still in its early phase, a surprise given the rapid onset of the fair's two most important deadlines, Dedication Day and Opening Day. Much of the park was still barren land, and the biggest building, the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts, was barely underway. A few buildings had advanced at a far greater pace and appeared to be more or less complete, in particular the Mines and Mining Building and the Woman's Building. There were so many distinguished-looking men in the park these days. Statesmen, princes, architects, and the city's industrial barons. Society matrons came as well to attend meetings of the Board of Lady Managers. Mrs. Palmer's great black carriage often came roaring through the fair's gate, as did the carriage of her social opposite, Carrie Watson, the Madam, her coach distinctive for its gleaming white enamel and yellow wheels, and its black driver in scarlet silk. Emmeline found that riding her bicycle was best in the days after a good downpour. Otherwise, the dust billowed like sand over Khartoum and sifted deep into her scalp, where even a good brushing failed to dislodge it. One afternoon, as Emmeline sat before her typewriter in Holmes's office, a man entered, looking for Holmes. He was tall with a clean jaw and modest mustache, and wore a cheap suit. In his 30s. Good-looking, in a way, but at the same time self-effacing and plain, though at the moment he appeared to be angry. He introduced himself as Ned Connor and said he once had run the jewelry counter in the pharmacy downstairs. He had come to discuss a problem with a mortgage. She knew the name, had heard it somewhere or seen it in Holmes's papers. She smiled and told Ned that Holmes was out of the building. She had no idea when he would return. Could she help? Ned's anger cooled. He and Emmeline got to talking about Holmes, as Ned later recalled. Ned watched her. She was young and pretty. A handsome blonde, as he later described her. She wore a white shirtwaist and black skirt that accentuated her trim figure, and was seated beside a window, her hair candescent with sunlight. She sat before a black Remington, new and, doubtless, never paid for. From his own hard experience and from the look of adoration that entered Emmeline's eyes when she spoke of Holmes, Ned guessed her relationship involved a good deal more than typewriting. Later, he recalled, "I told her I thought he was a bad lot and that she had better have little to do with him and get away from him as soon as possible." For the time being, at least, she ignored his advice. On May 1st, 1892, a doctor named M.B. Lawrence and his wife moved into a five-room apartment in Holmes's building, where they often encountered Emmeline, although Emmeline herself did not yet live in the building. She still occupied rooms in a nearby boarding house. "She was one of the prettiest and most pleasant young women I ever met," said Dr. Lawrence, "and my wife and I learned to think a great deal of her. We saw her every day, and she often came in for a few minutes' chat with Mrs. Lawrence." The Lawrences often saw Emmeline in Holmes's company. "It was not long," Dr. Lawrence said, "before I became aware that the relations between Miss Sigrand and Mr. Holmes were not strictly those of an employer and employee, but we felt that she was to be more pitied than blamed." Emmeline was infatuated with Holmes. She loved him for his warmth, his caresses, his imperturbable calm, and his glamour. Never had she met a man quite like him. He was even the son of an English lord, a fact he had confided in strictest